Session number 9005, Jeremy Black, Reel 5.
When I anchored up the Rajang River, where the ship's motorboat's engine power was not strong enough, so that if you lowered the boat in the water with the engine full ahead, it still wouldn't, it wouldn't stay there, because the river was roaring by. And so this little outboard craft seemed to be a good idea for allowing us to operate. But when the reckoning was done sometime later, it was seen not unreasonably that this shouldn't have been borrowed. I think that's what sort of started it going. Then they, having started to investigate, they actually got everybody out of the ship one morning, and for two or three days they went right through everything in the ship. And not surprisingly, one or two things came to light, as they would, I think, in any ship, really. So a large number of the charges were fair cop, right? You know, so I just let them pass, and I argued the toss on those that were more uncomfortable. And thanks to Henry Leach's advocacy, I came out reasonably well. I think that it was an important experience for me, because it did toughen me up. I'd had a pretty successful time up to then, and I think the Navy can be a bit public school in many ways. You know, you're in the womb somehow, and you know, you're playing for the first 11, as it were, and the whole of life is swinging along. And this was the first time that I came up against what you might call the real nasty world that we actually live in, rather starkly. And it was a very good experience for me personally, because it toughened me up. And you need to be tough, really, to survive. And so it was a good process. And I came back from that to Whale Island, and I taught gunnery there. I taught a long course of gunnery officers for a year or two. And then I went to join HMS. Oh, I taught commanding officers as well, that was the other thing, for a time. And chaps going in command of ships came to Whale Island for a bit. And then I went to...
Or were we non-gunners?
Yes, all gunners. I mean, any commanding officers, they still do it today. Anybody going in command goes around and gets taught a bit. And I used to play, used to organise that. Then... I went as gunnery officer of the new ship, the Fife, which was being built, the first computer-based operations room, and so on, all rather exciting stuff. But alas, having got there, which she wasn't at sea, but we were preparing, and I was learning all about computers and fascinated by the whole thing, but the program for the building was going back and back and back. I was, by this time, a lieutenant commander, and I couldn't afford time. It was a commodity. It was very precious, because in those days, if you didn't get made a commander in the first half of the promotions, you never went to sea again. So I was, I could see I was nudging against the stops. And I managed to get my appointment changed to the Victorious. And so I went as the gunnery officer and commander's assistant.
This is the
aircraft carrier. And I had a happy commission in the Far East as in those two roles in the Victorious, primarily as the commander's assistant. I was the sort of the administrator, really, for the ship.
Well,
we had some guns. Yes, we had 3-inch 50s,
yeah,
which were very successful, funnily enough. They were an American gun. I had four mountings of those. We were forever shooting down our targets and things, but the main task actually was this organisational one, and I did that for a couple of years. Then I finished that and joined the staff of the flag officer, what we now call the flag officer first tour. I mean, you know, the job that I now hold. And I was his gunnery officer for about 6 months when I was promoted to commander. And I went straight in to command the decoy at Daring, having already been the gunnery officer of Diamond. I then went back as the captain of decoy, joined her in Singapore, went right round the Far East, brought her home, went round the Mediterranean. Very good, very enjoyable commission in those terms. Not a very good ship, I think, in many respects. Diamond, decoy rather, I went to the Ministry of Defence for the first time, which is when I wrote these rules of engagement in the Directorate of Naval Warfare, under a chap who's now Vice Admiral, I think, retired, Bell Davis, Lance Bell Davis, whose father was got a VC in the First War. And from there I went as commander of the Kent, executive officer. From there back, I got promoted to captain. Back into the Ministry of Defence, which was the first time I got into this business about the future ship. I had excellent, a very good job, the future ship section of the Operational Requirements Division. Very good, excellent job, which I did for 3 years. And that...
You must have met everybody in that job.
Yeah. I was in with the shipbuilders and Bath and so on. Fascinating job. Controllerate. Dealt a lot with them. And from that I went to sea in command of the Fife for a very, very happy commission. Came back from that and went to the Royal College of Defence Studies for this amazing year which we managed to give people. 10 Army, 10 Navy, 10 Air Force, 10 British diplomats, scientists and government administrators, 40 Brits, and 36 foreigners from 20-something countries. And so we had a Turkish diplomat and a Greek captain and an Australian air commodore and a Nigerian educationalist or something. And for a year, with our wives and so on, they brought their wives over, we really learnt about the world. It started life as a course in strategy, but it's, you know, the interdependence of nations and so on, and strategic thought is now really boils down to a study of the world. And so we did this for a year, in the course of which I personally did a tour to the Middle East for a month and talked to Mr. Begin and his ambassador on the Camp David Treaty and Sadat's ambassador on the Camp David Treaty, and we went to Jerusalem, Amman, talked to Crown Prince Hassan, I think he's called, but you know, the King of Jordan's brother, met the chairman of OPEC, went to the United Arab Emirates, went all over Egypt. Gosh, it was interesting. We saw everything, went up on the Golan Heights and saw through the battle up there and saw their new irrigation schemes. And marvellous. A really marvellous year. And I got a letter this morning from an Indian general, because all these jets now have gone on, you know. There's, one is the Minister for the Azores, a Portuguese, whom I met in Portugal last autumn. In fact, Pam and I went to Portugal for a holiday. We rang this chap up at 11 one morning, and at 8 o'clock that evening, 8 of us sat down to dinner, 2 Germans, 2 Portuguese, and 4 Brits, all from this course. And I've just come back from the West Indies, where the Belgian ambassador was on the same course. And I've got this worldwide club now. Fascinating. And marvellously educational. Marvellous. I mean, there we met the media, we met... I remember Robin Day came and talked to us one morning. We met George Brown and Hailsham, and I mean, every day we'd have somebody of that sort of renown. People flew from the States to talk to us and fly back, or from Germany, or amazing. Marvelous. So I did that for a year. And then I went the head of the whole operational requirements, all future ships, missiles, sonars, the whole deal. Thinking I would see out my captain's time doing it, when suddenly one day out of a clear blue sky came the Invincible. And so I went off there for an exciting 15 months. And really that brings us up to today.
Yes. Did the Invincible occur before you were... at what point did you get the Invincible job? It was how long before the Falklands?
Oh, I joined it in January.
Yes.
I went to Falklands in, whenever it was, March, wasn't it?
Yes.
So not long, yeah. That's the answer. I joined, went to, I did a little bit in the Western, in the Western Approaches. I then went up to Scotland and did an exercise off Scotland. I then went across to Norway and exercised with 4-2 Commando and up in the snow. We came back from that and did a week's leave, and then off we went. So it was quite well timed in many ways, because we'd...
You just worked out properly,
too. Yeah.
There's not much left.
No.
Okay.
There's
a bit of... Can we do the last bit? Could I, sort of generalising, really, what would you say were the things that... Sorry, it's awfully difficult, impossible question. I'm sure everybody's asked it, and you skated right answering it. What do you feel you yourself learned from the Falklands? How did it change your attitudes?
On the whole, they were minor matters. I don't think it changed me in any enormous way. But a number of little things struck me. I think that as one has read so often in the past, that personalities play quite a large part in these affairs, and how the pressures on you, of course, are immense. I think the main pressures on me, I felt to come, generally speaking, not from the Argentinians, but from my own aircrew. There's always a great pressure on the captain of an aircraft carrier, the safety of his aircrew. And as you know, aeroplanes are fickle devices. But when they're fighting, it's that much worse. And of course, well, you know, I lost some and so on. But that was, in a sense, straightforward. I mean, they either came back or they didn't. But it was when you had a chap you knew was in the water and you had to try and find him. Or a chap who was running out of fuel, which happened several times, those sort of incidents. They were, to me, the real pressures. And the other real pressures, I think, were personality pressures around the force, rather than, really, the pressures of the Argentinians. When we were attacked, these exocets and so on, there was 4 minutes. You had 4 minutes from a first detection to a ship on fire and potentially written off. Now, in those 4 minutes, you had to get it right. You couldn't afford to make a mistake. And it was a pretty busy 4 minutes because there were a lot of things that had to be got right. And there really wasn't time to feel anything other than giving total thought to getting these steps right. I had a little team of only about 4 people who were involved in this. And whereas, you see, many of the ship's company might tell you how unpleasant it was to know that these things were winging about, these exocets, and wondering whether they were going to walk through the bulkhead or not, this little team that I was operating with, we were all so busy that there really wasn't a moment to think about that sort of thing at all, quite honestly. So, although it was an important moment and clearly had to be got right, you didn't have time to fuss about it. You just needed to get on. You couldn't afford not to be there. I mean, you couldn't afford to be caught in the loo, really, because there just wasn't time. You had to be there. I spent from about 6 every morning till midnight in the operations room, and you couldn't afford to go away from it. Over a period, I think I became fairly weary. I think probably I noticed that more afterwards than at the time, because I was getting, generally speaking, in midnight to 6 only in bed. So that was quite a pressure. But the sort of things which I've explained earlier about the those aeroplanes and who was in charge of them and what they were doing, those sort of relationships around the force, that caused me quite a lot of concern. And I learned a certain amount about that, I think, and the sort of relationships that I would try and build up if I was in a similar position to Sandy Woodward. The interest people have for their lives interested me. I mean, clearly we're all keen to stay alive, but in a way that I had never been conscious of in a ship before, this concern for people's safety, their own concern for their own safety, was more apparent than I think I had expected to find. On the way, once we left Ascension, people realized we were going to fight, or at least they assessed that we were going to fight. We were then having briefings nightly on the closed-circuit television by various lieutenant commanders about the Argentinian threat and what to expect. And somebody said to me after about 3 days, there's a lot of concern about it. A lot of people are very anxious. So the next night I got on the box myself for half an hour, and I went through above water, surface and below water, and said how I thought we might fight the battle. And my aim was to give an air of confidence about the whole thing. And quite, in a sense by chance, but in a sense to sort of lighten the thing a bit, I rounded up this half-hour talk by saying, and as far as I'm concerned, we'll piss it. And that, those few words were like setting fire to Dartmoor in the autumn. It lit up that ship. And these words, I mean, I've now got a picture with it on. If you could find over the mess deck door now, we pissed it with JJ and things like that. It just seemed to touch the chord at that moment when people were worried, and it lifted them all up in a most extraordinary way. But that was one example. And it's, you know, it's still referred to now. Then the other one was that aircrew, steely-eyed chaps as they are, nevertheless, they bloody well don't take risks unless they have to. And very reasonably, I don't blame them for it. But you might infer from what you've read of the Argentinians that they were, you know, they were prepared to do things which you could only regard in the cold light of day as being foolhardy, quite honestly, in many respects, or very brave, whichever way you like to look at it. I don't know whether ours would have done that or not. Maybe if our backs were to the wall, they would have taken those sort of risks. But by and large, they weren't in business to take unnecessary risks. And I'm not being critical of them for that, but I was very aware of it when I was commanding them, that they, just like the rest of us, wanted to come home. And the next time I think it was so apparent was after it was over, when there was a great flood of thanks, either directly spoken or indirectly, that I'd brought them through. Not that it was necessarily my doing, but But they attributed the fact that they were still alive, to some extent, to me. And one got this great flood of warmth. Now, it may be that this has always happened in action, so I just don't know enough about it. But I don't think it wasn't something that I was conscious of reading, and I've read quite a lot of military history. But I felt it quite strongly. Letters from their parents and gifts from people and all sorts of things. Very interesting.
Oh, like a housemaster.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yes, you know, when Willie gets through his A-levels, I suppose, same sort
yes,
of
thing. Yes, quite. I mean, I don't know, certainly when, you know, they have a, that you get this kind, although in fact it isn't really your, you know, and it's much more important the person who's taught him his maths or that he's done well at it. And yet you tend, as housemaster, to get the thanks because...
Yeah. Well, perhaps you're the focus. You know, that was very strong indeed. And left them a very unified ship's company, very starkly so. More so, I think, perhaps than I've ever felt before, after it was over.
Must be very sorry to leave.
Very, yes. Yes, I got the most lovely present from the... Well, I got several lovely presents, but one was a glass, cut glass bowl with presented to me from the officers around the outside, or engraved, and then an engraved picture of the ship and another of the Falklands, and with the dates of the different events. And then down in the base, which you can see if you look straight down on it, was the other OK phrase of the time, which was "there and back with J.J. Black." And they thought they wouldn't put "we'll piss it." But it's really I mean, it's so lovely. It's a museum piece. It's quite beautiful. Beautifully, beautifully engraved. And, you know, a number of other things as well. But it all indicated to me, you know, this concern which people had underneath, albeit not displaying it daily, because it came out when it was over that, in this sort of way.
Have you read Tinker's book?
I've read some extracts, enough to put me off. I don't think it's representative.
Well, not everybody has a left-wing parent who's professor of politics, really.
Right. Yes. I did not meet the chap who, at any stage down there, felt the futility of the operation. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't exist. And maybe he'd have been a brave chap if he'd said it to me anyway, if you see what I mean, because you don't normally tell your captain when you think he's a twerp. But, I mean, not only did I not meet him, but I didn't pick up that sort of flavour at all. And you normally do, I think, if it's about. I thought it was... There were a number of things. How many lieutenants write to their wife in that sort of vein? I put it to you, almost none. I mean, if I was to write a letter home along the lines of those published letters, well, I don't think she'd even read the bloody thing apart from anything else. I mean, certainly it's not the sort of thing she'd be looking for. And if I was, you know, when you're in an action setting like that, I think what you write to your wife, you've got to choose with a lot of care, because she's at least under as much pressure as you are, and perhaps more. And I doubt me that there are many people who wrote like Lieutenant Tinker or whatever he's called. There wouldn't be many wives who'd want that, would there? Yeah. So there's something in amongst it which is a bit funny. But then, of course, they were a bit funny, because I think his wife had already joined the army or something, hadn't she? Because I believe his wife was either in the army or the Air Force.
I think
I think it's there.
No.